I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Pauline Dakin joins me now. Her memoir, Run, Hide, Repeat, is a riveting book, one that's gotten a lot of good notices. Pauline and her brother are uprooted a couple of times by their mother, and their childhood is one that's spent on the run. When young Pauline asks why, her mother says she'll explain later. When Pauline's 23 years old and already a journalist, she's told by her mother, and Stan Sears, a United minister whom her mother has confided in, sought therapy from, and worked for, say that they've been running from the mob and that they're being protected by an elaborate covert group. Eventually, Pauline's fears for the situation she's led to believe they're in become suspicions. She realizes what's happened and lays it bare in this book. It's a compelling read, and I'll get Ms. Dakin to tell us as much as she'd like about it. Pauline Dakin is an assistant professor at the University of King's College of Journalism in Halifax. She's an award-winning journalist who has worked in radio, television, and in print, and is probably best known as the host of CBC Radio's Atlantic Voice and as a health reporter for CBC News. She lives in Halifax, but joined me from here in Vancouver last week. The book is published by Viking. Its full title is Run, Hide, Repeat, A Memoir of a Fugitive Childhood. Please welcome to the Plante on the Line program, Pauline Dakin. Ms. Dakin, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. I'm really enjoying the book. It's such a riveting read and something that I can't wait to finish. It's one of those books where if I'm interviewing the author, I'm actually looking forward to finishing the book after I do the interview. I understand that I'm chatting to you just as about your you're about to catch a plane going home. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been in Vancouver for about a week, and now I got to go back.
Yeah. Now, how much time have you spent growing up in Vancouver?
Well, I lived here until the summer I turned 10, and then I still had people here, and so I was out of touch with them for many years, but eventually I did, reconnect. So I was coming back quite regularly.
Yeah.
And I have a lot of friends here now, so I try to get back as much as I can. And, of course, it's my landscape. I always come home to Vancouver and think, oh, it's so beautiful. I love the East Coast, too, but all of this feels like home.
Yeah, and your father's no longer alive, is that right?
That's right, yeah. He died in 2006.
I guess this is a good place to start with your dad, because what sort of relationship was it like between the two of you, especially since your mom and dad divorced, and that was largely because of his alcoholism. Is that right?
Yeah. Dad was alcoholic. He'd been a soldier. He went to Second World War, and almost his entire platoon was killed. But I think by the time he was 19, he was a captain.
Mm-hmm.
So he'd had, some real challenges in his life, and I think he self-medicated with booze. And when he drank, he could sometimes be violent with my mom. There were a lot of strange things going on during my childhood, and I always attributed a lot of that just to what had happened between my mom and dad. It turned out not to be the case so much, but for years I was out of touch with my dad because we had, disappeared a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in my teens and I was feeling rebellious, I announced that I was going to go visit him. So we kind of reconnected briefly, and then fell out of touch again. But as an adult, I came back and we got to know each other again. My dad was this incredibly charming, genial man. He loved to entertain. He was very gracious. But he struggled, I think, with close relationships. So, I sort of had to meet him on his own terms and say, it might not ever be the close, loving relationship I'd like, but at the same time, I could really appreciate all that, he did bring to it.
And what did he do out here?
Well, he came to Vancouver after the war. He was a business guy. He was selling stocks and bonds and so on. He eventually became a developer. He did a lot of development in West Van and North Van.
Mm-hmm.
And his proudest building was a West Van high-rise, and that he, when he was dying, he wanted his ashes scattered nearby.
Yeah.
So, it was something he was really proud of and he loved.
And so when your mom and dad split up, one of the things that she does, I guess, is she turns to counseling. And is that right when she meets Stan?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. While I was here, I wanted to go back to the church where Stan worked as a minister back in the late 60s and early 70s, St. Andrew's United Church in North Vancouver.
Yeah.
And I went there, and I was able to go and sort of sit in the pew where my mom and Ted and I, used, my brother and I, used to sit. It was quite an experience. And that would have been, so she went to Al-Anon, which, the support group for families of alcoholics, and they recommended she go see this fellow Stan Sears. So he was a United Church minister and a counselor. And she saw him and within 6 months was feeling much better. Eventually she even went to work at that church for a while. But as a result of all of that, our families became friends. And so that's how Stan and his wife Sybil came into our lives.
Yeah. And so growing up for you and your brother Ted, after... before she meets Stan, I guess it's you know, I guess you're shuttled between your mom and your dad. Whenever your dad was available, I guess, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So, how does your life change once Stan is in the picture?
Stan was a really fun guy, and he was. He became kind of like dad to us. So we all would go camping. Mm-hmm. Stan was the guy who taught me how to build a campfire and how to, you know, stick an apple on the end of a stick and fling it into the river. And, you know, he was very engaged with us as kids, and you could tell he enjoyed being with us.
Mm-hmm.
But then things began to be kind of strange. I would often come home and Stan would be sitting having tea with mom and she'd be crying. And I could, you know, I always wanted to know what was wrong, and my mother would just sort of, oh, don't worry, just, you know, I'm leaky today, don't worry about it. But I knew something was going on. And, you know, I remember I'd come home after school and we'd be rushed out of the house and we've got to go, we're going to go hiking on Mount Seymour. You know, strange things like that. And when those things were happening, Stan and his wife were always part of that. So we'd all go off together overnight, even though it was a school night.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, later there were revelations about what was really going on. But at the time, it just seemed kind of bizarre and unpredictable.
Yeah. And so as a kid, you know what's going on, but I don't know whether you understand it or not. And it's not until, say, you write a book like this that you're able to piece together what's happened and sort of understand it all. When you do, can you see a moment where Stan's starting to go a little off, a little weird, perhaps?
No, I never did. I guess he never appeared weird or off to me.
Yeah.
But, you know, so when I was 23, my mother and Stan told me that the explanation for all of this stuff was that we'd been on the run from the mafia. And the stories around that became more and more bizarre as time went on. So he never seemed off. He always seemed very, he was, you know, emotionally available and very intelligent, and the stories were complex and believable, sort of.
Yeah.
But they got more bizarre. So it was the stories that began to seem off.
Yeah, so even at 23, when you would see him, or after 23, after you were 23, and you would see him, I guess what I really want to know is when you have this delusional disorder, can you see it on a person?
No, and that's the really distinctive thing about it. And it was such a revelation to me when I was doing the research for this book and discovered, I mean, I'd always wondered about this, you know, what it was that had prompted this huge hoax and this, you know, kind of hijacking of our lives.
Yeah.
And it was when I was doing the research for this book that I discovered a paper about what was described in the literature as being an extremely rare condition called delusional disorder. And the features of it are so distinct from, say, schizophrenia or other paranoid disorders, in that these people appear, for the most part, and completely normal. And I guess the more intelligent you are, the more you are able to sustain the delusion
or hide
in
it
a believable way.
Yeah.
And, you know, these are people that there tends to be an onset of the disease when people are a little bit older, so they're maybe they're educated and established in careers. They may have families and so on, as Stan did when this apparently started with him.
Yeah.
And they are able to have, you know, meaningful lives and you know, sustain things and still have this very fixed delusion that doesn't show.
Yeah. So I started the interview asking about your dad because I really wanted to know if he was mobbed up or anything like that. And through your research, I mean, none of that was true, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I think that part of Stan's delusion, for some reason, kind of accommodated my mother's feelings in some way. I mean, eventually Stan and my mom fell in love.
Yeah.
And so I feel as though the delusion that if anybody had been mean to my mom, somehow they became a bad guy in the delusion.
Yeah. There's so many things I want to tackle, and I'm trying to be careful because I don't want to give stuff away, and our time is limited. But his own family at this point, when Stan and your mother fall in love, you guys hung out together with his wife, Sybil. Were his kids in the picture at that point, or were they much older?
They were grown up.
I see.
And so I have I've since found Stan's surviving son and gone to talk to him, and we're now in touch. And he thinks, so he was just leaving home around the time that Stan began to talk about bad guys and people with guns, and this was also, you know, not long before he met my mother. So they were out of the picture by the time all of this was really happening.
Yeah. During this time that when you're 23 and you find out what's happening, or they tell you what's happening in their lives and how that affects everything around them, how much does your mother's behavior change?
Well, my mother's behavior had really started to change around the time that she left my dad.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that would be a normal thing to expect. So she had this depression coming out of this, you know, really traumatizing marriage.
Yeah.
But always throughout our lives after that, there, you know, you could see that she was anxious. You could see, you know, she was a very strong woman in many ways, but she was vulnerable in other ways, you know. So she would be quite emotional at times, and there was never any explanation for that.
Yeah, and see, I'm reading this book, and I've known of your book for a while because the book came out, I guess, in September,
mm-hmm.
And I've only started reading it in the last week or so and preparing for our interview, and I know about the book already, as I said, and so I'm reading it in a different context, especially in the last few weeks, when we're reading about the power that certain men have had in the media and in politics and the sort. And so I can't help think of your mother and just how a guy like Stan was able to manipulate her the way he did.
Yeah.
And so when you look at her life now, because she's been dead for a while, especially in the context that she believed into his scheme right up to the end. What's that like to see how different her life was because of Stan?
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny because it's a double-edged sword in
right.
the sense that Stan, yes, manipulated her, hijacked her life, isolated her from family and friends with these disappearances, you
mm-hmm.
know, when we would just leave and not tell anybody or say goodbye. And created a very stressful life for her. On the other hand, she would say Stan was the only person who ever really knew who she was and respected her. So my mom, you know, eventually as an adult went back to university, and it turned out she was a pretty good scholar. And that was never something that anybody else in her life had valued. And Stan valued that and encouraged her, and she would have said, she did say, you know, that Stan was the person who supported me and allowed me to become the person I became. So it's so complex. And of course, you know, my discovery about delusional disorder was such a relief to me because I could stop hating him for what he'd done, knowing that he had been sick.
Yeah.
So that kind of changed my perspective on it. But, you know, Stan was this, you know, funny, compelling, gentle guy who, you know, she just had so much respect for. She would completely reject that he had ever manipulated her. That would enrage her, mm-hmm. the idea of that. But obviously the circumstances that he created around us absolutely manipulated us.
Yeah, because you are, and I'm assuming your brother Ted as well, saddled with this fear, the secretiveness around you. And that can't be healthy at all.
No. Yeah, my brother and I used to spend a lot of time kind of debriefing and saying, what do you think it is? Well, could it be this? Well, could it be that? And at some point, you know, kids are pretty resilient, and it just starts to become kind of the normal dysfunctional thing. So you shrug and go, oh, well, there's that again. And it really wasn't until I was older that I think I was starting to feel the effects of so many years spent, you know, with this kind of mystery and unexplained tension in our lives. And that really did have an effect on me more, you know, towards the end of high school and beyond.
Yeah, and it affects, obviously, your relationships with other people and how you're able to trust again.
Yeah. I think for many years, I would let people get so close and no closer. And I, as I've been thinking about it, as I was writing, you know, part of it is, well, if you're going to potentially pack up and disappear next week and not be able to say goodbye to anybody, what's the point in really getting in too deep with friendships, right? Mm. But the other part of it being that there was this secret that kept distance between me and everybody else. Because you could, even when I was 23 and suddenly knew what it was supposedly all about, well, even more so, it's like I can't talk to you about this thing that is, in fact, controlling my life. Mm. So how close can you really be to somebody if you can't tell them about this major thing happening?
So how long was it that the shame went away for you?
The shame of having believed in this?
Yeah. No, or that, yeah, because you couldn't tell anybody what had happened. I mean, you must have carried some shame that you couldn't tell anybody what had happened and what was going on, say, in your mom's life and the person that she was with.
Yeah. I remember, you know, feeling a terrible kind of, yeah, shame is probably a good word. You know, there would be times that there would be interaction with, say, my mom's brother and his family or somebody like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you just felt like you were faking it all the time and lying to them. That felt terrible.
Yeah.
You know, always trying to negotiate the secret and still, you know, appear somewhat normal.
Yeah,
so that was very difficult.
Yeah, the other thing I've read parts of the book, the relationship between your mother and Stan, as you've already said, it's very nuanced. So it's very hard to make a full judgment to it. But you know, you mentioned earlier that he was a therapist, he was a man of the cloth, a clergyman.
Yeah.
I mean, it is dangerous, isn't it, that he is as educated as he is, and he has the influence that he has, not only on other people, but, say, the wider community.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah. And you know, this is one, ethically, of course, a therapist or a clergy member who is in a position of some authority should never be, you know, in relationship with somebody who has been in their congregation or in the therapist's chair, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, that's part of the complexity of the situation. And what happened was, you know, I think he fell in love with her first.
Mm.
And she kind of slowly, you know, she was very mistrustful of men, and slowly kind of came around. And then they did nothing about it for years. You know, I think they kind of knew that there were these feelings for each other, but nothing came of it for a long time.
Yeah, so then you sort of weigh these things now in your mind as you're reading the book. What was it, say, the disorder that you uncover, or could it just be the sort of scheming and ruse that he's created so that he can have this affair with your mother?
That was always what I thought before I knew about delusional disorder.
Mm.
It is likely some combination.
Yeah.
I guess I'll never know. You know, it's always going to be. There's always going to be some question about exactly what happened and what fed into what. But I no longer feel that it was such a malevolent thing.
Yeah. So to talk about delusional disorder for just a moment, because it's fascinating now that you've written about something that's hit so close to home. Are there signs? I mean, I was just thinking a moment ago, because this all happened in the 80s and the 90s, even earlier. In an online world today, would a guy like Stan have been able to pull off what he did, or?
No, not at all?
No,
I don't think so. It's interesting because, well, first of all, we're also connected.
Mm.
And so, you know, the stories that he would tell, well, if he was telling me that today, I would Google things.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I think we all would.
Able to do fact-checking, and that just wasn't the case back then. And I remember, in fact, a friend of mine here in Vancouver who was hosting my book reading, recalled, she was the first person I ever told about all of this. And she was recalling how we had talked. When I told her, I had said, I need to find a way to talk to the Solicitor General because I want to talk to somebody about whether this could be true. I mean, there were such limited ways to explore what was really happening, whereas now, you know, Google anything, right?
Yeah.
The other thing is that I don't think you could just disappear with a couple of little kids anymore. I think that there is a different culture around protecting children and vulnerable people, and that if you suddenly didn't turn up for school on Monday morning, and they couldn't reach somebody, I think there would be more people looking for you with more resources to find you.
Yeah. So when you talk to the academics, when you talk to the medical community, as you do in the course of this book, do you have a sense of how many people have this disorder today?
Well, according to the literature, it's a tiny number of people. And so, for example, much, much smaller than the incidence of schizophrenia.
Mm.
However, when you talk to the researchers, they say, we don't really know. Because these people appear normal and because they don't think anything is wrong with them, they don't go looking for help.
Yeah.
Now, the exception to that, there's different kinds of subtypes of delusional disorder. So Stan, I think, had paranoid delusional disorder with another subtype, grandiosity. So he had set himself up as being involved in this, you know, secret anti-organized crime task force and, you know, working with the government and all that. So, you know, that was the grandiosity part. But there are other subtypes that I think we do hear about and we just don't realize what we're seeing. For example, there's what's called a somatic subtype. So these are people who believe that they have maybe something growing under their skin or that maybe they emit a bad smell.
Mm.
And these are people who do look for help, but they don't go to see a psychiatrist. They go to see a family doctor or a dermatologist.
Mm.
And, you know, they may be more apparent to the world than somebody with paranoid type because the paranoid types are hiding this, you know.
Yeah.
There's also, you do hear about the erotic subtype. Every once in a while you'll hear about a Hollywood star who's getting some kind of a restraining order because somebody keeps, you know, turning up outside their door or sending them messages because they believe that that person is in love with them. And so they believe they're sending them messages that they're in love with them, so they keep turning up. So that's, I think, an example of where we do see it.
Yeah. And so what can we do if we see it? I mean, in an online world sometimes, you see people with delusions talking about them online.
Yep.
Is that something that you should, say, look into if you see someone do something like that?
Yeah, well, this is the thing. It's very difficult because, well, first of all, there are many different kinds of reasons that somebody might have a delusion. So it's hard to say, is that delusional disorder per se, or is it some other kind of psychosis.
Yeah.
But I guess if it's delusional disorder, people are typically very resistant to treatment. As I say, they don't think anything is wrong.
Yeah.
If for example, if I had said to Stan, look, I think you're having some delusions here, we should get this taken care of, his answer would have been, uh-oh, now you've been co-opted by the organized crime,
right,
and clearly you don't believe anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's very, very difficult for families and loved ones. And since the book has come out, I have heard from people all over North America saying, oh, my gosh, I never knew what was going on with my, you know, mm-hmm, stepmother, sister, son, but this sounds like delusional disorder. But there, you know, who do you appeal to? They're not going to go see a psychiatrist or a psychologist or therapist. Now, one of the researchers that I interviewed for the book said that he is considered one of the experts around the world on the topic. He's seen more of these patients than anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And he had some success treating them with a drug called Pemazide. But it later fell out of favor because it had some cardiac effects, some side effects. But he said, you know, I never used it in doses that would cause that. He still thinks that that would be a reasonable treatment, but the question would always be, how do you get people to take that treatment?
Yeah.
And he says it's not a cure, but it makes them less anxious and less attached to their delusions. So the big problem here, Joe, is that this is under-recognized, understudied, and there is so little knowledge about it that the general public would not know where to turn. And, you know, his hope is that this book kind of raises it as a possibility for research or for support groups for family or some clearinghouse for information, resources, that kind of thing. But at the moment, it's probably mostly family doctors who are coming across it, and they don't have much to turn to.
Yeah, and I guess they don't have the skills to recognize it quickly.
Yeah, some of them might, but I don't know what they would do if they did.
Yeah. Yeah. You write at the back of the book, Pauline, that some people might object to either their portrayal or the portrayal of other people that you write mm-hmm. about in the book. Have you heard from anybody since the book's come out who's raised objection as to what you've written?
Actually, I haven't. You know, I thought when this book came out, well, I thought two things. I thought that, you know, people who had been friends or family with my father would
yeah.
be very upset at how he's portrayed.
Uh-huh.
And I was wrong. People acknowledged that that was how it was. And that was very affirming for me, you know, that they wanted to support me. The other thing I thought a lot of people would say is, oh, my gosh, how could you have been so gullible and naive?
Mm.
And, in fact, you know, there was somebody who wrote a review for the book in the Winnipeg Free Press who said exactly that. But other than that, I have found that people are incredibly supportive and kind.
Yeah.
And that is not their response. They get that, you know, when you grow up with a parent who is loved and trusted, if they tell you something, you feel that you need to believe it. So.
Yeah. Is because so many of the players are dead, like your mom, your dad, Stan, obviously. When you write a book like this, it obviously provides some catharsis that you're able to have a better life because you're able to talk about these things openly now. I keep
yeah.
wondering if any of them were still alive, especially your mom or Stan, what they would make of the book.
Oh, yeah, I have thought a lot about that. I think they'd be horrified that
yeah.
I'd written it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I also think, I think so much about my mom. And she was my biggest supporter. And she was so proud of everything I ever did. And I have had the sense as I was writing it, you know, sometimes you can sort of still feel that you are in relationship with somebody even though they're gone, you know.
Yeah.
You're continuing to evolve in terms of your relationship to them. And, you know, I would like to think that somewhere, somehow she, you know, knows what's what. And I hope if that's the case that she's been able to forgive herself. And I think she would.
Yeah. And, I mean, and you obviously forgive her, right?
I have.
Yeah.
Yep. And I wish I could have done that while she was still alive. It didn't fully happen before she died. But yeah, I have.
Pauline, this is such a compelling and at times beautifully written book. I can't wait to finish it, as I told you. I appreciate your time today. Safe travels.
Thank you so much. It was good to talk to you, Joe.
The book is called Run, Hide, Repeat, a memoir of a fugitive childhood. It's published by Viking. Its author, Pauline Dakin, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.